Coming up on today's show.
I felt so blessed and lucky, and it's my job to, like, pass that anything along. And I think of most songwriters that I know of, most professionals, they're pretty much open to it as well, you know, in their own way. Everybody's doing things their own way, you know, to help young songwriters.
Cowboys don't cry.
Welcome to another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment, featuring interviews with guests who are having success in entertainment, primarily music. I am Bruce Wozniak, proud member of the Recording Academy, talking to guests who are singers, songwriters, musicians, recording artists, and more from the worldwide music community. Get in touch with me by writing to podcast@nhte.net, or instead of email, you can DM me through the @NowHearThisEntertainment Instagram account.
Oh, if life were like the movie.
Joining me today on location in Las Vegas, my guest has been a writer on songs for artists from Tim McGraw to Blake Shelton to Garth Brooks, Jimmy Buffett, Hank Williams Jr., Martina McBride, Lee Bryce, George Jones, Faith Hill, Thomas Rhett, and more. Along the way, he has been a writer on songs that did everything from go to number one and or earn nominations for some of the highest awards in country music. He is also prominently featured in the documentary about the fabled Bluebird Cafe in Nashville. He is here in town performing as part of the second Las Vegas Songwriters Festival. You have been hearing a song he was a writer on, George Jones's version of Here in the Real World. Welcome to Now Hear This Entertainment, Mark Irwin.
How you doing? Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
It's a unique environment. We're battling background music. But
it's Vegas, baby.
Adds to the authenticity. In case people were wondering, are they really on location? We wouldn't choose to have music competing with us in the background. Thanks. I appreciate you making time for this, especially when the glitz and glamour of Las Vegas tries to tempt so many people to go elsewhere. Let's start off by having you talk about George Jones's version of Here in the Real World, part of which was just playing during the intro. Later on, we're going to talk about you co-writing that song with Alan Jackson. But for now, just talk about not only the differences that the listeners will hear when they play the two versions back to back, Alan's and George's, but how you found out that George was going to record and release it, and dumb question, how that made you feel.
That was pretty amazing. It was about 5-6 years after Alan's version, you know, came out and basically catapulted him to stardom. And George Jones, we found out, was doing an album called Hits I've Missed and one I didn't. I guess there was one new song on there. But we pitched Here in the Real World to George Jones and to other folks before Alan recorded it himself, and they passed on it, George included. And then it was a big old hit for Alan. And I think he and George had a bit of a relationship once Alan started going out there and playing country music. George just included it on that collection.
Do you remember somebody calling you or emailing you or something and saying, guess what?
Yes. I wasn't with the publisher. When I wrote Here in the Real World, I was writing for a publishing company called 1010 Management, and the owner of that company, a guy named Barry Coburn, he called me to let me know that, and it was a real thrill because, you know, as everybody knows, George Jones, as far as I'm concerned, is the GOAT when it comes to country male vocalists.
You know, I find that there are certain developments where you get major news, good or bad, and someone's telling you on the phone, and your first reaction is, what?
Yeah, it's basically, are you sitting down? So once you hear that, you don't know what's coming.
Yeah, are you sitting down? Okay, I know who this is, so it can only be good news in that case.
No, it was a real thrill.
Wow. What a story you have, Mark. You were born in the Bronx and in 1987 moved from New Jersey to Nashville. What was happening at that point in your life, or I should say, what was happening with you musically, that prompted you to relocate?
Well, I finished college. I'm dating myself, but I graduated college in New Jersey in 1981. And I was working jobs, but I was also playing in cover bands and kind of fancied myself a songwriter. And I was writing as much as possible. And I was going into New York, Greenwich Village, quite a bit, playing at open mics, thinking that I was writing kind of modern style, new wave, you know, Elvis Costello, that kind of thing. And And I knew I always had kind of a country influence, and the folks there kept telling me, this isn't really what we're looking for. You know, it's kind of country. You might want to think about Nashville, and I never even thought about that. And then I did a little research and realized that Nashville was a hotbed of, like, a real songwriting community. I didn't realize that most country artists didn't write a lot of their stuff, and it was kind of akin to, do you remember the Tin Pan Alley in New York, where songwriters were writing every day, and folks like Frank Sinatra and all that were recording? It was kind of basically similar to that in Nashville. So, I mean, I think I had $1,500 in the bank, and I had my old Ford Escort, and I just came down without a name in my pocket just to investigate. I didn't know if I was going to be staying or anything. And my story, I just lucked out. I got a motel room. I knew about the Nashville Songwriters Association, which was up and running then, and I went there. And
let me interrupt you for just a second, because it sounds to me like you're saying you didn't know anybody there.
Oh, no. I didn't know anybody in Nashville.
And mind you, is it safe to say that the Nashville music scene was far less crowded 39 years ago than now? Not easier to break in the business, mind you, but was it just less crowded?
I think so. Yeah, I think so in general. Continue. Yeah. So I went into the Nashville Songwriters Association, and I was just talking to somebody, and a guy named Richard Helm, I remember, he recommended that I go to the Bluebird Cafe that night, because that was kind of a more of a local songwriter's hangout than it is now. It's kind of a major tourist attraction in Nashville, but then it was more of an industry and songwriter hangout. And a guy named Fred Knobloch, who's a great singer-songwriter, he was playing. And I went that night, and I started talking to this woman while I was sitting there watching the show, and she turned out to be the manager. And the next day I came in, you know, she said they were looking for somebody, a dishwasher and a barback. So I got a job there my second day in town, and one thing led to another.
Yeah, continue that story, because I mentioned back in the intro that you were prominently featured in the documentary that was made about the Bluebird Cafe, but that's the fun fact. You actually got a job there as an employee, not playing in a writer's round as it's known nowadays.
Right. It really helped me, because I got to meet a lot of people and I got to hear a lot of great music. I was there pretty much every night. And I was, you know, everybody from the newest writer in town to John Prine were stopping in and playing, you know, the impromptu sets and whatnot. It was a lot easier to get in and out of it then than it is now. And people, you know, I met other people who were new to town, songwriters, and we got talking, and folks told me about different places in town looking for songs and songwriters and artists. It was a lot of word of mouth, a lot of networking. And I would say, I mean, I give the Bluebird, Amy Curlin and the Bluebird Cafe back then, you know, a lot of credit for me getting my, you know, my career off the ground.
Yeah, there's a couple of really key points that you just made. Number one is, and I actually just wrote a blog about this on the website a couple weeks ago, that it's not just Nashville, but there's so many places that you go. I mean, granted, there's always the golden rule. Do unto others as you have them do unto you. And so the bartender might be an up-and-coming songwriter, the hostess at the restaurant, and so on and so on. I gave all kinds of examples in the blog. So here you were, that little did they know that, like, yeah, you're just trying to put money in your pocket, you know, but you're an up-and-coming songwriter. But I think the other thing you said is the networking, because I think what happens is people hear someone like you say that, and they go, well, he's bartending, though, so how is he connecting with the writer on the stage? It's like, well, maybe did from time to time, but those people who were coming to the bar, you were having conversations.
It was more that. It was more folks, you know, like me, new to town, didn't know where else to go to meet other songwriters or to just to, you know, where to go. And so I started talking with people as I was serving them. And I met this one guy. I remember clearly his name was Joe Collins. He was from Washington, D.C. And he got to town, I think, a week after I did. And, you know, he didn't know what to do, where to go either. But we started talking, and then he'd come back, say, a week later and go, hey, I had a meeting at this publishing company and they're looking for songs. They're looking for writers.
Wow.
So, you know, I was lucky that I was had a bit of a personality, and I was able to talk to people, and I met some folks who I still have relationships with today, 39 years later. Yeah.
Wow. The other key thing is songwriters have this amazing gift that the average music listener will listen to a song and they'll connect with it, they'll enjoy it for different reasons. But you as a songwriter were standing behind that bar and you were learning from the songs you were hearing, the phrasing, some of the things that they were doing with their songs, and you're going, oh, well, I might not be able to go and talk to that person, but when I'm not serving people here at the bar, I'm listening to what they're doing, and I'm just kind of studying their songwriting
style.
Or
it was happening, like, through osmosis, and you don't even realize it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I will say one thing, you know, even, like, the bigger writers of the time, they were not standoffish. I mean, they would talk, you know, in between sets. I mean, they were friendly for the most part. There was one guy besides Fred who I mentioned, a writer named Don Schlitz, who wrote The Gambler, and, you know, he's a hero of mine. And, I mean, we became buddies my first week in town, you know, because of the Bluebird. And he's, throughout my whole career, he was really good to me. I mean, if I had a mentor, if I called anybody a mentor, it would be Don. And I met him there at the Bluebird, and he was just really open to learning about me, learning my, you know, my story. And a few years later, he was open enough to, like, hey, why don't we write a song? I mean, it took a while, but we eventually did. And we had a song recorded by Tracy Lawrence together. So that was a thrill.
Yeah. And I think, again, you know, there's a couple lessons in there. Number one, that, okay, it's great that you started to become friendly with him, but you were kind enough to not try to jump on that right away and say, we should write.
Yeah.
We should
write. Oh, Lord, no, that, yeah. And I did see people doing that, not just with him, with other writers, you know, newbies in town, as we call them, going up to people and trying to, I think the expression was germing them, you know, just trying to get up close to them, germ, G-H-E-R-M. I don't know where that phrase came from. But, you know, and yeah, asking somebody who had no business to say, hey, we should get together and write.
Yeah,
and like your person go, why?
But that patience to just nurture the relationship, because people are probably sick and tired of hearing me talk about this on the podcast, write about it on the blog, etc. But it's just another example that, you know, especially in 2026, people will sit and watch YouTube videos, or they'll look at social media and they feel that they're learning there. But the power of the in-person conversations and you talking to these people, the relationships that you built, and here you are 39 years later still talking about those people.
100%.
I mean, granted, back then, there wasn't social media. Things were a lot different. I mean, sure, there was the internet, but you grabbed onto that early, and it sounds like you've just stuck with it.
I think networking is a big part of the music business, especially in Nashville. I think that's how you hear a lot of things that are going on, you know, like which artists might be looking for material at the time. And everybody's really open and giving. I mean, I think, yeah, you wish it was you who's having that next big hit. But if it's not you, you're always happy for anybody else. You gotta be happy for anyone who hits a home run, is how I always put it. And I think in other areas, like I understand, like in LA, the acting world, it's not quite as open. People don't share information about like auditions and things. I guess they figure the less people auditioning, the more I have a chance of getting the role.
Yeah.
But in Nashville, it was always been information like just flowed. You know, everybody wanted to meet the next great songwriter too and get close to them. But everybody was just really open with information.
But you didn't know that before you left New Jersey.
No.
Were there people in New Jersey trying to tell you, oh, I don't know about this, I'm not sure?
My mom, she goes, you've never been in the South before. And, you know, on one hand, she was right. It was like, you know, going to Mars as far as I was concerned. It was a big different. It got to the point where I thought I was being funny and at the Bluebird. And, you know, there was a community there of regulars, and we became friends, other people who worked there and people who were there every night. And I was just, I thought I was being funny, calling everyone Bubba. And next thing you know, that was my nickname. Some people still call me that.
I'm going to go out on a limb and ask you, how long did it take before you actually played at the Bluebird?
Good question. It was a couple of years. It was. They weren't doing an open mic like they do now. They do a Monday evening open mic, and then with Barbara Cloyd. They weren't doing that. There was the Sunday night songwriter show, and they had auditions. I can't remember how often. Nowadays, the auditions are once or twice a year, and they book the whole year. Mm. But back then, I think the auditions were a little bit more regular than that. So after a while, I think I auditioned and played on a Sunday night first.
Love that, though, that you auditioned.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't say,
oh, yeah,
I mean, I work here, I'm sure I can play anytime. You were humble enough to say.
Well, the woman who was running the Sunday night, she wasn't an employee of the Bluebird. Her name was, I can't remember her last name, was Gail somebody. And she was running the show, like it was her show that the Bluebird just gave her Sunday nights. So it was all up to her. And, you know, yes, everybody auditioned.
But still, though, you could have gone to the owner and said, I know you've got her running the show, can you tell her to put me on a show? And you didn't.
Yeah, so. I don't think. I mean, that's pretty much how I remember. I could be completely wrong, but I don't remember.
Let's go with my version.
Yeah. I really, truly, I mean, I'm not trying to sound, I don't remember any real special treatment as far as getting, it was just easier. you know, even after that, and I think it was even before I had anything recorded, they gave me a night. Like, I put a little band together, and they let me play. They split it with me and another writer probably on the same level. They were much more open back then to letting people come in and play. And and granted, most of the time we were playing to an empty room. You know, Bluebird, it took a while for the Bluebird to take off. I remember distinctly when Garth Brooks was doing well. He did an interview with Barbara Walters at the Bluebird Cafe, and it seemed like that was the beginning of it getting busier and busier and busier. And of course, then the TV show, the Nashville TV show, really just pushed it into the stratosphere, and now you can't get in.
Unless you're Mark Irwin, well, and you have the history that you do.
Well, they've always been, you know, I haven't worked there since, what, 91 or 92, and they still make me feel like family every time I go there.
Love it. Folks, you have been hearing me on and off the road for the last few weeks in the Los Angeles area for the interview 2 weeks ago with Grammy winner Darlene Coldenhoven, and now here in Las Vegas. There will be another trip coming up in October, and possibly a second that same month. I report my travels on this show and in the weekly e-newsletter and on the official at Now Hear This Entertainment Instagram account, all because of my desire to meet you, the audience, in person. I would love to meet, talk, take a picture, and get a chance to get to know someone from the listening audience a bit. Stay tuned, and if I will be in your area, do get in touch so we can meet. Write to me through podcast@nhte.net or DM me through that at Now Hear This Entertainment Instagram account. Mark, let's talk about getting your first cuts. The Randy Travis Christmas song, Meet Me Under the Mistletoe, and a bluegrass song recorded by Russell Moore and Third Time Out, which was nominated for Bluegrass Song of the Year by the IBMA. By all means, I would love to hear about any opportunity that someone got with Randy Travis, but then also for the other cut, what was it like writing for that iconic bluegrass band, and did you approach the song differently knowing it was headed for a bluegrass audience versus mainstream country?
That song that Russell Moore recorded was called Grandpa's Mandolin. Okay. I wrote it. I guess I met these guys at the Bluebird. I was still working there, and a guy, brothers, Billy and Terry Smith. Their mother was a woman named Hazel Smith, who was a music reporter in Nashville. Everybody knew her and loved her, and she eventually had a TV show and everything. And Billy came in, we became, you know, to the Bluebird, we became pals, and we just got together and wrote one day. And I wasn't too hip on bluegrass at the time, but they were real bluegrass players and lovers, and so I find myself, when I get into a room, I'm kind of chameleon like so if this is what we're going for, it's kind of my job to help them try to get, you know, get to their vision. So it was just like writing any other song. Once we knew what we were writing about, and it started out as Billy's grandfather played a mandolin, and, you know, and it was about the family, you know, and every time the grandpa played the mandolin, everybody gathered around, and that's what we wrote. We wrote the true story, and they got it to Russell Moore because they were in the bluegrass circuit, and they got it to Russell Moore, and next thing I know, it's not only recorded, but it was nominated for Bluegrass Song of the Year. And I was still working at the Bluebird at the time.
Wow.
I actually called my grandfather because he was still alive at the time. He was a New York Jewish fellow. And I told him about it because he didn't know what a mandolin was. He goes, "Now, what's a mandolin?" I go, "It's kind of like a banjo, but smaller." But, yeah, and it was great. I brought two waitresses from the Bluebird with me as my date to the awards, and we had a great time.
And the Randy Travis Christmas song?
That song, it was like, you know, you hear stories about, like, if you're out of Nashville, if you're out of town and you mail songs in, you get the song returned to you, it says that's not accepting it, unsolicited. But when you're in town and you're kind of getting part of it, I was writing for another, I wasn't a signed writer, but I was another songwriter at the time. His name was Dennis Morgan. He was helping me out. He was letting me bring songs to his publishing company. And when he came upon one that he liked, he would help me get it demoed because, you know, that was an expense. And his guy there would pitch it. And they pitched it to Warner Brothers, and they got it to Randy Travis.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And I always love that songwriters can recall specifics of things like the phone call that tells you, in this case, guess what?
Yeah. Randy was the guy at the time. That was big. I mean, that was big news. That was like today. That was like getting a Morgan Wallen cut, you know? So I was thrilled. I mean, that was exciting as hell. And I remember an executive at Warner Brothers named Martha Sharp. She was like the big A&R, head of A&R at Warner at the time. And she called us up and she let us come in and hear the cut. And, you know, that was just the biggest thrill of my life.
Do you happen to recall how long into living in Nashville that was that happened?
4 years.
4 years.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, I remember getting my cut, you know, my first cut in 4 years.
So how did that make you feel in terms of, I don't want to say validation, but kind of, okay, I'm on the right track here. You know, it's been a bit, but things are starting to happen.
Oh, this is easy now. I don't remember. I just remember going, okay, you know, with that, it helped me feel a little bit more confident about taking meetings with publishers around town to try to get a publishing deal. Cause that's what I wanted. At that point I was tending bar at the Bluebird and I didn't want to be a bartender. I wanted to be a songwriter. And I knew that publishers were paying the writers to, you know, a living wage, they call it a draw, so they can just wake up, have breakfast, and go write a song. You know, they didn't have to worry about, you know, income. And that's what I wanted. I wanted a publishing deal. And it just helped me, gave me a little bit more confidence to start going in and seeing people. And so then, you know, it definitely opened up a lot of doors for me.
So two follow-up questions. There was never a point in those perhaps 4 years where you thought, gosh, when is this going to happen for me? Should I go back to New Jersey? There was never a thought of that.
There was nothing for me in New Jersey. You know, I thought I thought I was in the thick of it. And, you know, and you don't realize it at the time, but it happens in stages. I mean, before that cut, the Randy Travis cut, I'm sure I had one or two songs that looked like they might be getting cut. They might have been put on hold, a little activity, and then it didn't happen. And then the Randy Travis one did. So everything kind of happens in stages. And you just kind of going along with the flow, and the 4 years went by pretty fast. You know,
nice, yeah. Nice. There was something else that you started to say in there, and then you went a different way. I mean, you said, "You know, I didn't really want to be a bartender," and I thought he's going to say, "I didn't really want to be an artist." Was there ever a time when you were looking at this as, "I'm going to Nashville to be a songwriter and a recording artist"?
Not really. I didn't think I had it in me. You know, I didn't think I was a singer. I didn't think, you know, back then too. I mean, these were some good looking guys. So I always wanted to be a songwriter, and I love, you know, it's really funny because now at this point in my career, I'm gone from home a lot, playing out and playing songwriter festivals and shows and corporate gigs, and I'm having a blast. But I never thought about, oh, I'm going to try to get a record deal and be a big old star. I just didn't think that was me.
But clarify for me, when you talked about growing up in the Bronx and then going to college in New Jersey, you were talking about going into New York and doing open mics and things of that nature. So just help me understand, having done that and then getting this vision for Nashville, but saying, well, no, even though I was doing open mics, so were you doing
those? I was just really inspired by, like, songwriters that I loved, people of the time, like, you know, Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, Jackson Browne, and I just wanted to write great songs, and I wanted to play music. I knew I wanted to play music, but the idea of trying to get a record deal just seemed so far-fetched, you know, seemed impossible, that I just never even considered, like, really trying to do that. But then, you know, I always kind of stumbled into things in my life. You know, I never really had a plan, you know, good or bad.
The Indiana Jones approach.
Is that right?
Of just make it up as you go along.
Yeah, and I still am. I have no idea what I'm going to do tomorrow.
So when you were on stages in New York, were you testing out songs to see if the audience liked them?
Yeah. And I was, you know, also trying to meet people. I did want to be in a band. I knew I wanted to be in a band just to play and stuff. Okay. And I was trying to meet other people doing it. But I was also, testing the waters on the songs I was writing.
Nice.
I guess maybe in my mind, I thought maybe there was a chance that, yeah, maybe I could be, you know, I mean, I never thought about it consciously, like if I wanted to be an artist per se. But I did always enjoy playing and writing, and I just never really thought about it, you know? Yeah.
As long as we're talking about big names now, like Randy Travis, let's go ahead and get into the story about meeting Alan Jackson and writing Here in the Real World.
Well, I was bringing songs. See, because of the Bluebird, I met folks who said, hey, there's this new company in town. They're owned by this couple from Australia, Barry and Jewel Coburn. It's called 1010, and that was the address of the building, 1010 16th Avenue. And they said they were looking, you know, they're always looking for songs and writers and stuff. And I called up and, you know, we planned a meeting and I brought them in a couple of songs. And, you know, they liked a few. They didn't jump on me as, oh, you're our guy. But they kept the door open, said, please keep bringing us songs and stuff. And there was one song I wrote with a great songwriter at the time. I met him at the Bluebird, too. His name was Ron Davies. His sister, Gail Davies, was a country artist, but he was just a great songwriter and the sweetest guy in the world. And we wrote a song called God Loves Me. And it wasn't a gospel song. It was like, I know God loves me because he sent me an angel like you. And at the time, Barry Coburn, besides being a music publisher, was also a talent manager. And he was managing an artist named Holly Dunn. and she recorded. They liked that song enough to play it for Holly, and she recorded it. Mm-hmm. But it just never came out. It never, you know, like often artists will overcut for albums. They'll, you know, if there's 10 songs on an album, they cut 12, and then you get the news. Sorry, man, the album it didn't make the album. That's a whole nother story. but that solidified my relationship with 1010. And Barry was starting to manage this young blonde-haired singer from Georgia, Alan Jackson, trying to get him a record deal. And everybody said no at least once, maybe twice. But he said, he asked me if I would be interested in writing with him. And so he took us out to dinner one night, me, Alan, and Barry, and Jewel, I'm sure, was there too, and had a few drinks, had dinner and stuff. And
Tell the audience how big my eyes got when you said that.
Yeah, and they said, why don't you guys come into the office and write one tomorrow? And we did, and that day we wrote two songs, one called Here in the Real World and another song called Till I Was Loved by You that ended up being recorded by an artist back in the 90s. Her name was Shelley Wright. So that was a good day. And, wow. You know, I mean, I was probably the first New Yorker Alan ever met. He was probably the first guy from Georgia I ever met. And so I wouldn't say we became the best of friends, but that was a great day. And he's been good to me over the years, you know. And then it seemed like, boy, looking back, I'm sure it didn't happen like this, but it seemed to happen fast for him. You know, once he got a record deal, it seemed to take off. But, of course, it didn't happen. He had one song come out that died. And he wasn't, I don't even think he was too sure about Here in the Real World himself. I have to give that to Tim Dubois, who was running the label. He's the guy who signed him to Arista. Mm-hmm. And it was his idea to put it out as a single. And as Alan says, when he plays it live, he goes, and once that happened, I never had to work another day in my life.
Did you come to that right with Alan with this title? With the
no,
hook,
it was
with
Alan's
anything?
Title.
It was.
He says, I have this idea. I don't know what to do with it. And he had the first two lines, Cowboys Don't Cry, Heroes Don't Die. And I don't know, I used to go to a lot of movies back then, so it just clicked and the song fell out.
Wow.
You know, the phrase here, I don't know who came up with the phrase Here in the Real World, but it was definitely him having those two first lines that got the ball rolling on the song.
And then what was it like watching the album that you'd co-written the title track for get a CMA Album of the Year nomination, and how did it feel seeing Alan Jackson win the ACM Top New Male Vocalist Award right out of the gate?
Oh, it was a thrill. It was really a thrill, and he was great during the whole thing. Again, like I said, you know, we weren't close. We weren't the best of friends, but every step along the way, he made sure, like, how much he appreciated the fact that I was willing to write with him, a basic unknown at the time. He was completely thankful. He called me every time, hey, you know, the song's going number 10 next week. Hey, it's going number 5 next week. You know, every step of the way.
He was calling you himself.
Because, yeah, he was calling me himself. Wow. And we didn't have cell phones back then. So I remember when the song was going number 1, he knew that he heard that it was going to be going number 1 then the following week. I was at a friend's house, a girlfriend's house at the time. Her name was Jennifer Barnett. And I don't know how he got the number, but he called me there. And he told me it's number 1 next week.
No
and he
kidding.
Thanked me for writing it with him.
So educate the audience on, you write this song with Alan. And I think there's a tendency for people to say, well, then, since it did so well, wouldn't Alan just write all the time with Mark? And it doesn't necessarily work that way in
the
business.
No, because, you know, once the career takes off, boy, they are busy. You know, you have your whole life to write your first album, and then you have about 6 months to write your second album. And his life, and fortunately for him, he had like albums worth of material, you know, when his career took off.
Okay.
And we did get together once or twice since then, but nothing came of it. But he just had all these great songs. He had Chasing That Neon Rainbow. He had so many great songs already written. He had, like I said, he had 3 albums worth of hit material already written.
Well, and let's face it, you know, labels get involved.
Yeah.
Publishing companies
yeah.
get involved.
Yeah.
Other writers get quote-unquote assigned.
Yeah.
So
and Barry has always been good to me, but like for just because of circumstances, once the song was a hit, we couldn't really come to like terms for me to stay with 1010. And I signed with a company called EMI at the time. And I don't know if like, I wouldn't say that like that stood in the way of me getting back with Alan, but just, you know, our paths just went a different way.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. I am joined today on location in Las Vegas by hit songwriter and guitar player, Mark Irwin. You will find him on both Facebook and Instagram. Plus there is a playlist on Spotify that features some of the songs that Mark has been a writer on. He is here performing at the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino as part of the second Las Vegas Songwriters Festival. Find their website at vegassongwriters.com. They have social media that you can engage with as well. I'm going to make an educated guess that the 3rd annual edition of this event will maybe take place in August of next year. Put it on your calendar to make plans to attend. On last week's episode, I was bemoaning the fact that the hot tea on the flight to Las Vegas was not good at all. To take it one step further, I forgot to mention that, and I won't say the name of the hotel, but it's not Mandalay Bay. When I checked into my room, there was no coffee maker and no microwave oven. Ugh. So help your friend Bruce to get a good hot beverage. Show your support for this podcast. Let me know that you like the show. On my podcast website, nhte.net, there is a bright yellow buy me a coffee button so you can do exactly that. In fact, you can buy me more than a coffee if you'd like, three coffees, five, whatever. You will see others before you who have done so, both guests and listeners alike, and the messages that those folks have posted, plus what I wrote back to them. And by the way, they are not a sponsor. They're not paying me to talk about them. And quite frankly, they very likely don't even know that I'm talking about them. Again, go to my podcast website, nhte.net, and then tap or click on the bright yellow Buy Me a Coffee button. Mark, we are in a time, 2026, when the music business is still having to wrangle with not only streaming, but even clips of music that gets used in social media posts. Looking back to the 90s, that was a good time to be Mark Irwin because throughout that decade, you were writing, getting cuts, and records were selling big.
Yes. You could, I had a conversation about this recently with someone. You know, right now it's so single driven, but back then albums, like you say, were selling so well. You can make a, have a great career, make a great living just having album cuts, you know, because most country artists who were like doing well, I mean, they were selling, they were going platinum, double platinum, triple platinum. So, and you know, the money, the mechanicals were coming in, and it was a great time to be here. It was Camelot.
Marla Cannon Goodman, who is here at this festival, she and I did an interview last November in the Alabama, Florida Panhandle area at the Frank Brown International Songwriters Festival. And she said that for those of you that are songwriters, meaning you're not recording artists, that the model has become, in light of what is happening in 2026, the Mark Irwins of the world, as you already said, are going out and doing a lot of live performances at festivals.
It's like we're lucky that we have these opportunities because it's great. We call them streams of income. You know, it's a great way to make up some money that, I mean, it's nothing like having a hit song, but I mean, it's pretty, still, it can be pretty lucrative getting out and playing so much. I'm out, I'm on the road once a month at least, and then doing a lot of in-town shows as well.
Now, how can you forecast committing to a festival that's months and months in advance and then all of a sudden having those plans and you get some big call where it's an opportunity that it's, you know, this is going to be for insert big name here. Can you say, that's fine, I'll write from my hotel room, I'll do it over Zoom? How do you manage that knowing I've already made a commitment to this festival? And yikes.
Well, like the one good thing about songwriting, especially in 2026, like you said, if you're writing with somebody, hey, this person only has this day to write. And if they're willing, they can't, you know, if you're not in town, you can write over Zoom. But fortunately for me, that doesn't happen too often. But I have a friend here, another writer here, Brian Davis. We wrote a song last week and he's working on the demo and we want to tweak it a little bit. So we're getting together this afternoon in his hotel. He brought his computer and his, we have our guitars and we're going to work on it a little bit this afternoon.
Yeah, the more that I've gone to songwriters festivals over the years, the more that I've heard that a lot of you who live in Nashville are so busy in Nashville that you don't get a chance to see each other until you travel out of town and see each other at another festival.
It's true. Or at least have not have the time to get back together. You know, we've gotten to the point where we're so used to trying to write a whole song in one day. You know, sometimes, you know, you want to make the song better and you want to get back on it and try to improve a line or two or tweak it. And but our schedules are so busy in town, our publishers keep us hopping that you never get that opportunity. So now we're here and say, hey, you know, I got a couple hours this afternoon. Why don't we get together?
So I'm going to fall on my sword and forgive my naivety, but it sounds like you are with a publishing company currently.
Yes, a company called Smack. It's owned by, I believe it's owned by a great songwriter named Shane McAnally. And his partner there, I'm sure there's other partners, but one of his partners there, woman who got off the ground with him is a woman named Robin Palmer. And she has been a real champion of mine my whole career. She signed me to EMI when I left 1010. And we worked there for a few years. And then we worked at another company in the early 2000s, a company called Anchor Down. And this is our third deal together. She's just been really good to me, and I'm thrilled. I call this like the fourth quarter of my career, and I'm thrilled that I'm spending it with her. And the rest of the staff at Smack are amazing. It's a great company,
but you know,
people.
I think people who are just music lovers, hear about people like yourself traveling to these festivals and they think, oh, well, I'm sure that Mark is performing and doing this interview with Bruce and then he's going to probably go out and enjoy the strip. But it sounds like that you do very much use these as business trips that, yeah, if somebody wants to sit and write with me, yeah, I'm going to sit and write even though I'm in Las Vegas.
I mean, don't get me wrong. There's a fair share of, you know, still partying and stuff. But, yeah, I'm here to work too. You know, I mean, the gigs, I mean, I have a gig this afternoon. I'm not going to drink all day and then go do the gig and, you know, or hungover. I want to be on my best. Sure. And like we said, sometimes, other writers here that you haven't had a chance to get back together, well, you just try to take advantage of the time, you know. Everybody's a professional, you know. I mean, if you have this image of like it's all a party, it's really not. It's a lot of hard work, a lot of tedious work, long hours.
There's something that you hinted at earlier that I want to revisit. In 1999, you got a song cut for the Dixie Chicks' Fly album, but lost it before release. Do you remember when you found out it didn't make the final track list?
Yeah.
And did hearing the finished album make you think, man, my song would have fit right in?
Oh, Lord, that was that's a tragedy in my life. Because that album that it was cut for went on to sell like 9 or 10 million Fly. That might have been their biggest album. It would have been a life-changing thing. But so they recorded it as a duet with an artist who had a record deal at the time. His name was Daryl Dodd, and he was doing pretty well. And they recorded the track, and Daryl did what they call a scratch vocal, just a quick vocal to guide the band. And he had to come back in and do his real final vocal, but he got sick. He got a disease called encephalitis, which attacks the nervous system. And he lost the ability to sing well. He was a great guitar player. He lost dexterity in his hands, so he was never able to go back in and finish it. And at the time, I remember saying, well, why don't they just find somebody else to
finish
it?
That's what I'm wondering.
I go, no, it was supposed to be Daryl. And, like, they were really loyal to him. The Chicks were, and as well as the guy named Blake Chance. He had Sony Records. He said, no, this was for Daryl. We're not, you know, this wasn't just a publicity stunt. They wanted to do a song with Daryl.
Okay.
And I understood that. And, you know, I mean, it was, but I didn't know all this was going on. I had a song meeting at Sony. You know, sometimes I'll bring in songs. They're A&R people. They're listening to songs for other upcoming projects. A guy named Cliff Aldrich Sr., his son Cliff Jr. is here, actually. He was an A&R guy at Sony. He allowed me to come play him some songs. He passed on all of them. I remember that. And then I said, hey, can I hear my Dixie Chicks cut? And he goes, yeah, sure, because the album was done. It wasn't out yet.
Yeah.
I go, yeah. He said, which song was it? And I told him, and his face went white.
Oh.
He goes, nobody told you?
Boy.
And that's how I found out at a meeting there. And I just walked out. I was in, you know, like, I mean,
oh my gosh.
Yeah. But I tried to look at it as, you know, I went and wrote a song the next day. Daryl had a record deal he lost. You know, he had a career that he lost. So I'm trying to, you know, it was a tragedy for him. For me, it was, you know, a big bump in the road, but I still was able to continue doing what I loved. So I'm trying to look at it like, you know, I mean, it could have been a lot worse. Yeah, it was a real sad, you know, and from what I understand, the track with his scratch vocal is on YouTube. You can hear the song. And some radio station in Texas was playing it, and I understand the label sent a cease and desist order to make them stop playing it because it was taken away from their single at the time.
They didn't
want to lose spins.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay. Rob Hatch is here performing as part of the Songwriters Festival. Back on episode 642 of this show, he and I talked about a lot of timing things. When he moved to Nashville, getting his first number one song 7 years later, and then having a huge year 6 years after that, and so on. The point being, Mark, it's crazy that for you, you got your second number one song 17 years after the first one, yet you got your third number one five weeks later.
That's better.
Clearly, all you can predict is that it's all unpredictable. But share with the audience about that journey as well as those two songs.
Well, in that 17 years, I mean, I was getting songs recorded. And like we said, albums were selling, so I was doing fine. And there were actually some singles. They just didn't go number one. But yeah, 17 years later, a song named Redneck Crazy that I wrote with my good friends Josh Keir and Chris Tompkins, two great songwriters. It was recorded by a new artist named Tyler Farr. I was writing at a small company then called Red Vinyl, and I remember the story of my song plugger, Emma Robinson. She was out having drinks with Lee Bryce because she was trying to play him the song, and they went into his truck and played it, you know, the CD player, and he goes, "This is a great song. I don't think it's for me, but my buddy Tyler is looking. Can you mind if we play it for him?" And she goes, "Yeah, sure." And he heard it and related to it for whatever reason. And he cut it like a week later. and it was his first number one.
Wow.
In the meantime, this other song that Josh and I wrote with the Warren brothers, Brad and Brett Warren, a song that we wrote for Tim McGraw, that Highway Don't Care, that got cut, and it was out around the same time, and it went number one, you know, a few weeks later.
Do you know how it got to Tim?
Well, the Warren brothers, Brad and Brett, they had a relationship with Tim. They could send songs directly to him.
Okay.
Plus, my publisher at the time, I was writing for Missy Gallimore. Missy's husband, Byron Gallimore, is Tim's producer. So we had that connection as well. But I think Brad and Brett sent it right to Tim. But, I mean, Missy, you know, she found so many Tim hits over the years. So we were pretty tied in. I mean, I will say that. It was pretty tied in to Tim. We wrote it thinking of Tim all along.
Well, another roller coaster you experienced was of the emotional variety. I'm referring to having a number one with Blake Shelton, but then having your co-writer
pass away
soon after.
Yeah, that was, I mean, we wrote that again with Josh and another writer named Andrew Dorf, who was really, his career was taking off. He was just a great lyricist and a great guy. And when the song, we wrote, it was his idea. That was one of those songs that the stars aligned. We wrote the song. We knew Blake Shelton was looking. He had that idea. We wrote the song, and Josh, he was doing tracks back then, so he did a demo, and we got it sent to Blake's producer. It got put on hold, and it was cut a week later, and I think it was even released, like, within the month. I mean, that all it doesn't happen like that too often.
Wow.
It happened fast. And so, and Josh, him and his family, they travel quite a bit, so they were out of town when that song was climbing the charts, so it was just Andrew and me. And Andrew already had a number one, and I guess I had three at that point. And so we were checking in with each other every day, you know, hey, you know, checking the charts and seeing the spins. And you could, on media-based charts, you can see how many spins it was getting each day. So we would call each other. It was like crack to see where it was. And 15 minutes later, hey, you see where it is now? So, you know, Andrew and I got to experience that together. And then I guess it might have been a year later when he passed away. So, you know, now when I play that song out, I feel like it's like a double blessing in my life, you know, having those, you know, the song went number one and did everything a number one song does for a writer, but also give me those great memories of that time with Andrew.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it's a real special moment. That song's real special. If I learned, you know, I tell this when I introduce the song, I still have voice memos from Andrew on my phone, and he ended every message the same way. He would say, love you, buddy. And so if that song taught me anything, it's just like, if you have a chance to tell someone you love that you love them, never pass it up, because you don't know what's coming.
Amen. Amen. It's interesting to me as a podcaster, and folks, I hope you know that I am a publicist. That's my real gig. But it's interesting to me as a podcaster that you talked about, we would keep checking. It's like crack. We'd look, because I think we've gotten past this, but there used to be a time in podcasting when podcasters would get accused of always checking their stats, always checking their stats. How many downloads, how many followers and things like that. So the message to podcasters was like, just do a good show, put out good content. But I imagine that when a song is having the momentum that Neon Light was, you go, hey, hold on a minute. Like this could be on target for number one.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, any songwriter who has a song out now, they're constantly thinking about that. I mean, you know, they're so hard to come by. Cuts, let alone singles that are climbing the charts, you know, you get excited and worked up about it. And yeah, you're checking the charts. You know,
well, let's be honest. You know, it's a foregone conclusion. But again, that person who listens to Now Hear This Entertainment, that's not in the business, that just enjoys music, your stock just continues to rise and rise. The more cuts you get, the more number ones you get. So you're looking at that very much from a business standpoint, not just an excitement standpoint.
Yeah, 100%. Plus, you know, financially as well, as a writer, just like an athlete, you know, you want to ring that bell. You want it to be number one. You want to be able to say, I have, you know, this many number ones under my belt. It's the barometer, I guess, of our careers, you know, of how well we're technically doing, you know, business wise.
And we're at what number as of mid 2026 for number one hit songs?
I've had two bluegrass ones as well, number one. So I have six number ones altogether. Now there's a lot of people who have more than that, and that's great, but I'm very happy with my career.
Please.
And Yeah,
there's so many people that never get a number one.
100%.
People that leave Nashville great because they never get a cut.
Great songwriters who, for whatever reason, the stars didn't align for them. And it's a sad story, actually, when a lot of great writers, you know, never got recognition and never got their music heard. But, you know, so, yeah, I'm no complaints here at all.
And, you know, it's making me think very early on in our discussion, I referenced 39 years since you moved to Nashville. Here we are in the second half of 2026, and you continue to write and mentor young writers and work with military veterans nearly 40 years after that young fellow who left New Jersey.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel really blessed, really lucky that I have this life. And, you know, people were really good to me when I first came to town. There was one writer who I'm still friends with. His name was Bernie Nelson. He was at the Bluebird. He was dating one of the waitresses. But when I got to town, he had already had a song recorded. And he kind of, so he took me around, showed me the ropes. He drove me up and down Music Row, introduced me to people. I mean, just real kindness. And Don Schlitz and others, Fred Knobloch, he wrote me. I asked Fred if I could, you know, back then we had cassettes. And I gave him a cassette of like three songs on it. And he sat down and wrote me a 6-page letter, what he thought of the material. I mean, he took the time to do that for me. And it wasn't an ego thing. I think he really cared about songs and songwriters, as I do. So I'm meeting a lot of young folks these days, and it's interesting because I've had so many songs since Here in the Real World, but that's the song that a lot of these young writers coming to town, they want to talk about, the one that they're so attached to, because there's a real love. It seems like there's a real resurgence of love for real country music, traditional country music, whatever you want to call it. And I don't know, you know, I mean, I just see them, they're coming to town business-wise, probably at the worst possible time to have a career as a songwriter, but their love for writing songs and country music is so strong, they don't care or they're not thinking about it, and I find that kind of inspiring. It's just pure love for the music.
Wow.
You know?
So where in your story did your desire to work with military veterans come from?
I was doing a show. My nephew, he lived in Chicago at the time, and he was hosting writer shows in Chicago, and I was playing one of them. Andrew Dorff was playing that night, and so was Shane McAnally and a woman named Brandy Clark. And this guy after the show came up to me. His name was Richard Casper. He was an Iraqi war veteran. He was a little bit of a buzz. He said, you know, I'm a little drunk. So I was kind of like, you know, a little bit leery of him. But he asked if he could buy me a beer and talk for a minute. I go, sure, you know. And he told me that, you know, he'd just gotten out of the service. Mm. He had some, I think, 2 or 3 tours of duty. I can't remember exactly. But he lost friends there, and he had a couple of close encounters himself, and he's had suffered from PTSD, and he started like kind of just like learning how to play the guitar, and he thought like writing about his experience would really help him, and it did. So he wanted to do that for other veterans as well, and it was all his baby, his idea, and I was just open to it, and I loved the idea. It was called, he came up with a company called Creative Vets. And it's become so successful now because of him. I said, at the time, I said, well, you know, if you come to Nashville, I'll definitely do what I can to help introduce you to people, get you meetings and all that stuff. And honestly, when I left that night, I thought, I'll never hear from this guy again. But it's probably a month later, he called me and he was in town. So we started writing songs for him.
Gosh.
First, it was for him, you know, talking to him about his story. And they said, hey, this friend of mine, he lives so-and-so. If I fly him into town, would you do this with him? I go, of course. And now it has really taken off where, like, they have their own brick-and-mortar building in Nashville. It's not just, you know, like, so it's like music therapy. And I think it's gotten grants from the government, you know, like if they've given them grants to work with veterans. Plus, they're doing actual art as well as music, you know, as ways of dealing with PTSD. And it's one of a few different organizations out there that work with veterans. There's another one called Operation Song that does kind of the same thing. You sit down with a veteran and he or she tells you their story, and you kind of help them put it to music, and you know, and but it's pretty much them writing the lyrics. Mm-hmm. And you just see the look on their face is like, you know, that I don't know, that they really accomplished something, and they really, I think they get something out of it that like they never dreamed of. And I think it helps them keep moving forward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's wonderful. There's something though that it's got to be within you that you made the conscious choice that I am going to mentor young writers, because let's face it, someone can get 4, 6, however many number one songs, bluegrass, country, it doesn't matter, and they can say, I'm not going to deal with these young people. Like, I had to figure it out the hard way. Like, they can put in the time on their own. So I'm taking my hat off to you that you obviously made the choice, unless it's just, that's just my makeup, Bruce, that you decided, I don't care that I've had 6 number ones. Like, I'll help the young people.
I mean, to me, it's just like, I felt so blessed and lucky, and it's my job to like pass that anything along. And I think most songwriters that I know of, most professionals, they're pretty much open to it as well, you know, in their own way. Everybody's doing things their own way, you know, to help young songwriters. They might not sit down on a one-to-one basis like I do with a few folks. You know, there's people who work for Nashville Songwriters Association, which helps many songwriters. There's the music licensing company that a lot of songwriters are a part of to help make sure that future writers are going to get paid fairly. And so there's a lot of songwriters, you know, in a lot of different ways trying to help the next generation of songwriters, you know, come up and, you know, make it a lucrative, worthwhile career.
I'm going to say God bless you anyways, because there are a lot, but we know that there's some out there that are going to say, too bad, I had to learn the ropes the hard way, but, and you're going to also.
But it's in every line of work, too, and every, you know, there are people that, too, you know? And I, you know, on one hand or another, I kind of get that, where like, well, you know, I never took a songwriting class, or I never sat down and, you know, like, had somebody teach me the ropes about it. But I had people who showed me kindness, and, you know, in certain ways they were doing that. I just, maybe I didn't realize it at the time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. I pay it forward, right?
Amen. Amen. We're going to close with the demo of Highway Don't Care, which was ultimately a Tim McGraw song that featured Taylor Swift and Keith Urban. Mark, you co-wrote that with Josh Keir and the Warren Brothers.
Yeah.
Take us back to that write, but also at that time, could you and or the others possibly have imagined it at that time as a triple artist track with Tim singing the story, Taylor as the voice on the radio, and Keith shredding the solo? Or did that concept emerge in the studio?
That was all. Well, we did write a section in it. If you'll hear on the demo, there's a little section with a female vocal on it, and it's kind of staticky because it was supposed to sound like he was the protagonist of the song. The lead character was hearing this on the radio. They didn't do that on the record. That's probably for the best. But we always thought that maybe his wife Faith Hill would, you know, like we were thinking of Tim when we wrote the song, and maybe Faith would want to sing on it. After that, once Tim got the song, it was all his idea. I don't know if Faith said no or if he ever even played it for her, but it was his idea to ask Taylor Swift to play on it and to have Keith Urban play guitar on it. So, No, we never imagined that. We never imagined how big it would get. We never imagined that the night before it was released, Taylor Swift tweeted about it. And I think that, like, got more and more radio stations to play it, like, the first week. I mean, the spins the first week were amazing.
Wow.
You know, and so no, we couldn't picture any of that.
So was that just simply a writing session, or did you know you were writing it for Tim?
We were thinking Tim. We knew he was looking. Like I said, the Warren Brothers, they had a bit of a relationship. They might even have been writing, like he might have had some of their publishing. I'm not sure. But they've had other songs recorded by Tim before that. And, you know, they had a good relationship with him. And like, and I was writing for, the company was called Red Vinyl at the time. It was owned by Missy and Byron Gallimore, who was working with Tim. So we knew Tim was getting ready to cut a new album. So it was, I remember succinctly that it was Brett Warren's title. And Josh usually sat, we wrote it in Josh's office. He was writing for a company called Big Yellow Dog at the time. And we were upstairs in his little studio. And he usually sat at the piano. But he got up for some reason, and Brett sat down and started playing this progression. And Josh started, these words just started coming out, and we were off and running.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. And I was going to ask you, similarly to how we talked about here in the real world, I was going to ask you, you know, did you come in with the title?
That was Brett's title written down. That was definitely his title. I remember that pretty well.
Have you found over the years that you have a preference for already having the title for Bruce? I always want to have the hook first. Or is it just, it really varies from song to song?
For the most part, especially for commercial, yeah, you want to have a great hook. You want to, you know, there are days I take off, I call them studio days, and I'll just sit there for a couple of hours just trying to come up with great titles and great hooks. Mm. So I'd be prepared when I go into other, to future writes.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
No, because writing to the, and these days, we write, you know, I've been doing it so long. I feel like when you write every day, it's like you're exercising a muscle. So the more you do it, the better you get at it, and the easier it is to call it up. So these days, the writing isn't what takes that long. It's figuring out what you want to write about, and, you know, it's figuring out the hook, and then say, once you know what you're writing, the song usually falls into place pretty quickly.
Yeah, as you just said about Highway Don't Care, yeah. Once he got that, you said
yeah, we were off and running. Yeah.
Yeah, amazing.
Even with, I mean, even back then, I wasn't writing quite that much, but here in the real world, I remember it fell out once we had that hook, you know, it's going to be about the movies, you know, somebody said here in the real world, and next thing you know, the song actually dropped out in about 45 minutes. Mm. Yeah, that was a good
results
day.
Results not typical. Flashing at the bottom of the screen.
Not at all. You know, there have been days I've had like, you know, 8-hour days where we didn't come up with a verse. So, you know.
Yeah.
I remember a songwriter named Jim Rushing. This is before we were writing on computers and writing on our phone. When we bring in yellow legal pads, you know, he goes, sometimes, you know, you sit down with a yellow legal pad and a pen. 3 hours later, there's nothing on there. He goes, well, that's songwriting too. You know, because some days you just don't come up with it.
Wow. Mark, this was amazing, as I knew it would be. Thank you ever so much. I appreciate you making time to be on Now Hear This Entertainment.
Thanks for having me.
You bet.
Okay.
You bet. Audience, with that, I will wrap up another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment. My sincere thanks to hit songwriter and guitar player Mark Irwin. I have followed him on both Facebook and Instagram, and I'm sure he would appreciate you doing the same. For that matter, tell Mark you heard him and his music on Now Hear This Entertainment. Keep up with him on social media to see the festivals that he plays at so you can go see him live in person. Remember to look for the playlist on Spotify that features some of the songs that Mark has been a writer on. Again, he is here as one of the performers at the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino as part of the second Las Vegas Songwriters Festival. Find their website at vegassongwriters.com. They have social media that you can engage with as well. As I said earlier, I'm going to make an educated guess that the third annual edition of this event will likely take place in August of next year. Do put it on your calendar to make plans to attend. That will do it for episode 655. Thanks ever so much for listening. I will send you out today with the demo for the Tim McGraw song that Mark just talked about. This is Highway Don't Care.
Bet your window's down and your hair's pulled back. I bet you got no idea you're going way too fast. And you're trying not to think about what went wrong. Trying not to stop till you get where you're going. Trying to stay awake, so I bet you turn on the radio and the song goes. I can't live without you, I can't live without you, baby. I can't live without you, I can't live without you, baby, baby. The highway won't hold you tonight. The highway don't know you're alive. The highway don't care if you're all alone. But I do, the highway won't dry your tears. The highway don't need you here. The highway don't care if you're coming home. But I do. Got a dead cell phone and a shotgun seat. Yeah, I bet you've been the gods here talking about me. You're trying not to let the first tear fall out. Trying not to think about turning around. Trying not to get lost in the sound. But that song is always on, so you sing along.
I can't live without you, I can't live without you, baby. I can't live without you, I can't live without you, baby. I can't live without you.